This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, sitting in for Dan Raviv, CBS News correspondent Howard Arenstein.
In a moment, we'll hear about this emotional week of testimony at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. And later, a handful of retired generals want Donald Rumsfeld to resign for mishandling the Iraq War.
Secretary of Defense, who didn't understand leadership, who was abusive, who was arrogant, who didn't build a strong team.
And Rumsfeld's reaction.
If every time two or three people disagreed, we changed the Secretary of Defense of the United States, it would be like a merry-go-round.
Also, a CBS News investigation by Armin Katyan on illegal immigrants working for federal dollars.
Despite dozens of arrests at military bases around the country, government construction sites continue to be fertile ground for undocumented workers.
In Alexandria, Virginia, admitted 9/11 conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui once again confounded his defense attorneys, who are doing their best to save his life. Correspondents Jim Stewart and Barry Bagnato are covering the trial.
Zacharias Moussaoui might as well have walked up and slapped each one of these jurors in the face just when you thought you'd heard the most cold-blooded statement possible. Moussaoui went one better.
Make my day, Moussaoui exclaimed when shown pictures of 9/11 victims. Do you have any remorse, he was asked. None whatsoever. Wish there were more. No pain, no gain. Even defense attorneys' arguments that Moussaoui was in jail on 9/11, never meant to be part of the main attack, and paranoid schizophrenic to boot, seemed to evaporate in the face of Moussaoui's own damning words. Are you crazy, prosecutors asked. Thank God I am not. But your lawyers say so. It's a cheap argument. Most Americans think it's crazy for anyone to fly an airplane into a building. We do not think so. And asked if he had any sympathy for the relatives of victims who wept as they testified to their loss, Moussaoui replied, I'm glad they suffered. I wish they suffered more. It was a final insult to Abraham Scott, who lost his wife.
I know a lot of people ask me about him becoming a martyr. If he's put to death, let him become a martyr.
This is Barry Bagnato. Contrast Moussaoui's hate-filled comments with the heartbreaking stories told in court about September 11th victims and their relatives. The jury heard Melissa Doy's desperate pleas in her 911 call from her 83rd floor World Trade Center office. You might want to turn your radio down for 20 seconds or so. This is difficult.
No smoke, right?
Of course there's smoke!
Ma'am, you have to stay calm.
There is smoke! I can't breathe!
The dispatcher tries comforting her.
I'm gonna die, aren't I?
No.
I'm gonna die.
Ma'am, say your prayers.
Security camera snapshots showed the moment American Airlines Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, a bright orange-red fireball, then black smoke rising into a clear blue sky. Coolly, clinically, prosecutors displayed gruesome photos. Exhibit P200042, charred human remains on a blue tarp. Moussaoui yelled, burn all the Pentagon next time. Jurors were riveted hearing the cockpit recording of United Flight 93's final moments before it crashed into a Pennsylvania field. Orders barked in chopped English, don't move, shut up, sit down, followed by tortured cries, no, 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 over and over, and then, please, 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 don't hurt me, and I don't want to die, three times. Sounds of a scuffle follow, then a hijacker says in Arabic, that's it. Again in Arabic, is there something, a fight? It was the passenger revolt. The next 5 minutes are filled with passenger cries, let's get them, broken glass, loud thumps.
A powerful, heroic effort. Spontaneously created.
Alice Hoagland's son died on that flight.
You can still hear the drama rising from the back of the plane as this desperate little group of guys ran forward to try to seize control of the airplane.
The recording ends with chants of Allah is the greatest, and then silence.
Correspondent Bob Schieffer spoke about Moussaoui's bizarre defense with our legal analyst, Andrew Cohen.
Andrew, some people would say this man is crazy. Others would say he's just mean. Do you have any idea what his strategy is here?
I don't think there is a strategy, Bob. And if there is one from the defense attorneys, it all went out the window. You've heard about runaway juries. This is a runaway defendant. His lawyers don't know what he's going to say. I think on some level, he doesn't know what he's going
to
say.
And at one point, he wanted Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, to be brought in to testify for him?
Exactly. I mean, you know you're in trouble, Bob, when Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, the guy who's spending life in prison without the possibility of parole, is your big character witness. We don't know if we're ever going to see Richard Reed. If we do see him, we have no idea what he's going to say, but it just gives you a sense of the tumult that's going on inside the defense camp now. The lawyers want to present a mental illness defense. Moussaoui doesn't want that. He's been off the charts on what he wants. Sometimes he says he wants to die a martyr. Sometimes he pleads for his life. Jurors are going to have to sort it all out.
In Tehran, this week, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad described Israel as a rotten, dried tree ready to be annihilated by one storm. That came only days after he declared Iran had managed to enrich uranium and is well on its way to producing nuclear weapons. More from Chief White House correspondent Jim Axelrod.
Iran's leader claimed Iran has joined the nuclear club, using clips of plants and production facilities. Iranian officials now say they have a working chain of 164 centrifuges, those machines that spin uranium into nuclear fuel. Though making a bomb requires thousands more, if true, Iran has crossed a critical bridge toward producing a nuclear weapon. So after repeated demands from President Bush for Iran to stop enriching uranium, Iran's combative president said, no way. The announcement comes after recent reports the Bush administration is planning strikes on Iran's nuclear plants, which officials once again dismissed.
Someone comes up with an idea, runs it in a magazine or a paper. Other papers pick it up and reprint it. Editorialists then say, oh, henny penny, the sky's falling, and isn't opine on this and opine on that.
At this point, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld is clearly trying to dial back on any saber rattling, even while Iran is saying when it comes to a nuclear program, no one will tell it what to do.
The United States of America is on a diplomatic track. That is the president's decision. That's where our European allies are.
Reaction from the British, seriously concerned. The Germans, another step in the wrong direction by Iran. The French, Iran must stop its dangerous activities. And Russia, urging Iran to stop all enrichment work. But clearly the U.S. speaks loudest and most confrontationally. Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove said about Ahmadinejad,
he's not a rational human being to deal with. And we're going to have to use every diplomatic tool of the United Nations, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and our partners in Europe to bring pressure to bear to stop this.
Correspondent Trish Regan was in Durham, North Carolina this past week following the allegations there that members of Duke's lacrosse team raped an exotic dancer.
Police released audio tapes of a conversation between one of the very first police officers to see the alleged victim and a police dispatcher. These tapes seem to back up earlier statements from defense attorneys representing the lacrosse players that indeed this woman was impaired.
10-4, you need a medic truck or you took her?
She's breathing, appears to be fine. She's not in distress. She just passed out drunk.
The new tape will likely only give more ammunition to lawyers hired by Duke lacrosse players who charge that Durham District Attorney Mike Nifong, in the midst of a re-election campaign, is pushing this case more as a politician than as a prosecutor.
Correspondent Trish Regan. Coming up, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld under fire.
Stay with us. The CBS News Weekend Roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Last week on this broadcast, you heard retired General Tony Zinni call for the resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. This week, more generals jumped on the bandwagon. Here's Chief White House correspondent Jim Axelrod.
What makes this all particularly stinging is that all these generals served in high-ranking positions under Secretary Rumsfeld, and many were intimately involved in the fighting or planning of the war in Iraq.
Major General Charles Swanick and Major General John Riggs, both retired from the Army, are the latest to call for Rumsfeld's resignation. In Time magazine, a retired Marine General, Gregory Newbold, called for, quote, replacing Rumsfeld and many others unwilling to fundamentally change their approach. Last month, retired Army Major General Paul Eaton wrote in the New York Times that Rumsfeld was, quote, incompetent strategically, operationally, and tactically. Asked for the president's reaction to this growing line of criticism, his spokesman relayed clear support.
Yes, the president believes Secretary Rumsfeld is doing a very fine job.
On Friday, President Bush issued a statement expressing his full support for Rumsfeld, saying his energetic and steady leadership is exactly what's needed at this critical period. But that's not what retired Army Major General John Batiste thinks. He spoke with correspondent Harry Smith on the early show.
First off, the most important reason, single most important reason you think Secretary Rumsfeld should resign.
Harry, it has to do with accountability and leadership.
I just get the sense from looking and reading the opinions of you retired generals who want Rumsfeld's resignation that he just literally was not listening enough.
Harry, that's my opinion. We went to war with a flawed plan that didn't account for the hard work to build the peace
after we took down the regime. We also served under a Secretary of Defense who didn't understand leadership, who was abusive, who was arrogant, who didn't build a strong team.
You know, it's interesting because we've interviewed the secretary here, and one of the issues that, right from the beginning of the war, are there enough troops on the ground? He said, well, I'm relying on my commanders on the ground, and we suggested to him, well, maybe your commanders are telling you what you want to hear.
If you're talking about the process to build the plan to invade Iraq and build the peace, I think the secretary's comments are disingenuous. I think he built that plan the way he wanted to, without regard to the CENTCOM work for 10 years to build a deliberate plan. You know, the hardest part of war is building the peace. You've got to own the ground. You've got to change people's attitudes and give them alternatives to the insurgency. You've got to intimidate the insurgency. You've got to go after him day after day. And that takes boots on the ground.
An active general just back from assignment in Iraq was asked this past week at a Washington think tank whether Rumsfeld should quit. But Lieutenant General John Vines stayed away from the controversy.
I support my Secretary of Defense. If I were to tell you that I agreed with that assessment, I would be stepping outside that lane. I have absolutely a clear-cut choice. I either support my civilian leadership or I must remove this uniform.
A reporter from the Al Arabiya TV channel, Talal Al-Haj, had a chance to ask Rumsfeld himself about the calls for his resignation.
There are, I don't know, what, 6,000 generals, active duty, retired, and there's thousands of them. And there are several who are not on active duty, who don't have, not current, who have made comments. And that doesn't surprise me at all. In the middle of a war, that people are going to disagree with this or have different opinions. We have different opinions inside this building all the time.
You are the third longest serving Secretary of Defense.
Is that right?
Yes, sir. And and with all this being directed against you by some members of the retired generals, do you, Mr. Secretary, intend to serve the president until the next elections?
I intend to serve the president at his pleasure. And the fact that two or three or four retired people have different views, I respect their views, but obviously if out of thousands and thousands of admirals and generals, if every time two or three people disagreed, we changed the Secretary of Defense of the United States, it would be like a merry-go-round around here.
So by the next election, you'll be the longest serving Secretary of Defense, sir.
Oh, that remains to be seen.
Thanks in part to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Americans have gotten to know quite a bit about Islam over the last 3 years. But you may not know that it's the fastest growing religion in America. And this Holy Week, in a search for new faces of faith, correspondent John Blackstone found an imam who's trying to change the way Americans think about his religion.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
At the Salaam Mosque in Sacramento, California, the call to prayer echoes with tradition. But the leader of the mosque is anything but traditional. Imam Mohammed Aziz delivers his Friday sermon while his 2.5-year-old daughter darts among the worshipers.
We ask you, O Allah, to make us good brothers and sisters.
He prays 5 times a day, prompted by a high-tech reminder.
I can't live without it.
Your BlackBerry vibrates when it's time to pray.
Yes.
The modern imam.
That's what people call me.
He's young for an imam, just 30. Came from Egypt 6 years ago. Graduated from Ohio State. His daughter was born here. His wife, Kauthar, seems no less modern.
The whole headscarf and everything, it is part of what being a Muslim is about.
You're in denim. You're in blue jeans.
The fashion changes, you know. Yeah.
Since September 11th, much has changed. The imam now worries about his wife.
She was called a raghead at one point.
He's afraid even little Zainab could be a target of intolerance.
I'm scared, you know, to let my kid play outside, you know, for fear of any person to attack her.
His answer, though, is not to hide out, it's to speak out.
Please join me in welcoming Imam, that means the prayer leader, Aziz.
At interfaith gatherings, he tries to build bridges across chasms of misunderstanding.
Almost everyone in the Middle East thinks that America is on a crusade to Christianize the Muslim world, okay?
I really hope that's not the case, but that's what people believe.
He declares that keeping this country safe from terrorists should be as much a priority for American Muslims as anybody else.
I want to carry a gun and stand at the border and protect the border myself because I'm the first person to be impacted.
But the challenge facing Imam Aziz is reflected in a new CBS News poll. Fewer than one in five Americans has a favorable view of Islam. It's a stereotype, Aziz says, that Muslims themselves must work to change.
Any group that comes to this country, they have to pay the price of being part of the system, and we're paying our price.
Worth it?
I think it is. I think it is.
The imam hopes the bridges he builds will help make Islam an accepted part of America's religious mosaic. John Blackstone, CBS News, Sacramento.
Coming up, undocumented workers getting paid federal funds, and Easter and Passover converge in the Holy Land.
Stay with us. The CBS News Weekend Roundup will be right back.
Buenas tardes, hermanos y hermanas, hermanitos.
The main language was Spanish at big rallies across the country on Monday, part of a passionate debate over undocumented workers.
The solution is to go ahead and give them that guest worker pass.
This week, a CBS News investigation found some of those illegal immigrants are working for federal dollars. Companies with government contracts employ them, and many of the jobs are near sensitive military bases. More from Chief Investigative Correspondent Armand Katayian.
It's a little after 7, and already work is in full swing at this Groton, Connecticut construction site, the future home of military housing for officers serving at the nearby Trident submarine base. The U.S. military subcontractor pouring cement at this site, Gargiulo Construction, says its payroll is completely in order. But in reality, some workers' papers are fake.
Raise your hand if you are an undocumented worker.
These men, all born in Mexico, are here illegally and fear talking to the press can get them fired. Talking about false papers and pay that is less than half what a union member makes.
¿Cuánto gana por hora? How much do you make an hour?
$13 an hour.
13.
The reason for the roundup? Illegally making North Carolina their home.
Despite dozens of arrests at military bases around the country, government construction sites continue to be fertile ground for undocumented workers, something Centex, the government contractor in Groton, was hesitant to discuss.
We're going to have to wait until we get approval to talk with you.
Hal Parmalee is their man in charge at Groton.
From our perspective, they have all documented workers based on the information they've supplied us.
That information boils down to a green card and a Social Security number. Easily obtained, all these illegals say, for as little as $200 on the streets of New York.
Does your employer check your documents to make sure they are legal?
Sometimes they check your documents, sometimes no. If you show up to work, they need you to work. So that's not always the case. But it almost doesn't matter because they'll treat you as if you don't have any rights.
Health and retirement benefits, forget it. That's not even part of the equation.
Mark Ehrlich is head of the New England Carpenters Union.
The law says that it is illegal to knowingly hire someone without papers. The word knowingly is key because hardly anyone is ever prosecuted because an employer can simply say, well, I didn't know.
Company president Gene Gargiulo flatly denied knowingly hiring any undocumented workers. But in the wake of this interview, according to the Carpenters Union, 8 Hispanic workers were fired the very next day, sparking a walkout by 24 Hispanic workers on Gargiulo job sites. In response, Gargiulo said he had not dismissed anyone, declaring the workers had, quote, voluntarily walked off the job, and furthermore charged the episode was orchestrated by the union.
Chief Investigative Correspondent Armand Katayian. White House correspondent Peter Mayer reports now that the lower President Bush's popularity rating gets, the more folksier he seems to sound when he talks.
Howard, much has been made of President Bush's appearances at tightly controlled events. The White House goes to great lengths with carefully invited audiences, the selection of panel members who are sometimes coached before Mr. Bush arrives, and elaborate backdrops promoting the theme of the day. But there are flashes of what's been described as the unscripted President Bush. It happened on Wednesday in Jefferson City, Missouri, where he talked up the Medicare prescription drug program. The president welcomed retired dairy farmer Bob Vanderfelts.
When I first met him, I said I like a guy with a snap-on shirt.
But Vanderfelt's also revealed just how much White House advance people check on the folks sharing the stage with the president.
Tell everybody about yourself right quick.
Your people asked me when they called me if you're going to wear a suit. I said, no, I'm not going to buy one. I don't have one. Yeah. So.
I wish I didn't have to wear them, believe me, you know.
This exchange proved to be a crowd pleaser.
Still on a dairy farm I was born and raised on.
Really?
Isn't that interesting? Yes, sir.
Man of the land. And that's great.
Nothing like it. And yeah.
You got big hands.
Still there. I know how to milk. Yeah, that's what you do.
And the unscripted moments can be telling. Sitting casually on a stool, Mr. Bush poked fun at his own challenges explaining the Medicare drug plan.
One way to convince people to take a look is to have others talk about the benefits of the program. They probably got a little more credibility than I do. Yeah. You don't have to agree with it. I'm just telling you it's a good deal.
That was a giggling panelist, Helen Robinette, at the president's side, describing her own experiences signing up for the drug plan.
We were kind of dense and didn't understand it.
No, so listen, you're not alone. But this can be confusing to folks.
It is.
That comment came just a day after the White House rejected complaints from some lawmakers who believe the Medicare prescription drug program is so confusing that the sign-up deadline should be extended. For now, the administration is holding firm on the May 15th date. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Peter Mayer at the White House.
It's Easter week and it's Passover week, and it's a holy week in the Holy Land. Here's our Jerusalem correspondent, Robert Berger.
Bells summon the Christian faithful to prayers in Jerusalem's Old City during Easter Holy Week. A throng of pilgrims is marching with palm and olive branches here in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Priests in red robes are leading the procession as a cloud of incense engulfs the ancient stone tomb believed to be the site of Jesus' resurrection. Jerusalem is awash with pilgrims thanks to a lull in terrorism. Kevin Drew came from Prairie Village, Kansas. He told CBS News that Jerusalem during Easter brings the Bible to life.
It's always been a fantasy of mine to have a time machine and to be here when all this happened, and this is as close as I can get.
Security is especially tight because Easter coincides this year with the week-long Jewish holiday of Passover. It began with the festive Passover Seder meal, recounting the Exodus from Egypt more than 3,400 years ago. David Katz, who immigrated to Israel from El Paso, Texas 14 years ago, says he's used to it.
We have to go on living and functioning, and we all conduct our lives normally, but of course there's extra concern, and we see the extra security on the streets, but we all continue to go about with our daily affairs.
Israel celebrated Passover as it marked the end of an era. 100 days after Prime Minister Ariel Sharon suffered a massive stroke, Israel's cabinet declared him officially incapacitated and named Ehud Olmert to replace him. Olmert plans to pick up where Sharon left off when he pulled Israel out of Gaza in August. Olmert, who won national elections last month, intends to relinquish large parts of the West Bank while annexing big settlement blocks. The aim is to separate from the Palestinians and draw Israel's final borders by 2010. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Robert Berger in Jerusalem.
And I'm Howard Arenstein.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news on the CBS Radio Network. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Tens of thousands of people gathered on the National Mall here in Washington early in the week. It was part of dozens of rallies across the country to call for immigrant rights. Among the speakers, Senator Ted Kennedy, who was one of the leaders of the unsuccessful battle in the Senate to pass immigration reform.
I look across this historic gathering and I see the future of America.
This is a demonstration here, right in front of the U.S. Capitol, with a Latin beat. Some of these immigrants from other countries are dancing to the beat of the Latin music and holding up signs saying, we are not criminals, and immigrants are America. There's one woman who's holding up a sign who's come here all the way from Charlotte, North Carolina. How long have you been in the United States?
I live in the United States 35 years.
So you're a citizen?
I'm a U.S. citizen.
Then why are you demonstrating?
Well, I try to demonstrate that all the Spanish people are together. We want to be legal in this country. We are part of the United States.
As President Kennedy proclaimed a half a century ago, we are a nation of immigrants. And today, we stand together as brothers and sisters to shape America's destiny.
All we're wanting to do is here work for a better tomorrow for our kids. That's all we're wanting.
Now, you got the U.S. Capitol right there in front of you. What message do you have for the congressmen and senators?
All I'm wanting is for them to understand that we're not wanting to hurt anybody. That's all we're wanting is work. Basically, as much as doing work as cleaning floors, cleaning toilets, people get paid really low amount of money to do these kind of hard work because it is. It's really hard, and they get paid minimum wage.
I was born and raised in America, and I love this country, but my parents are both Hispanic. My father's from Puerto Rico, and my mother's from Panama.
Why is it important to demonstrate here today?
Because I would like for these illegal immigrants to be able to vote and have freedom and be able to enjoy the life that I have as a legal American.
Immigrants and the part they've played in building America is one of the themes of a new Broadway show. Dan Revive recently spoke with the woman who created it, a woman of many voices.
Now a Broadway star, a chance to speak with Sarah Jones, the star of Bridge and Tunnel. Yeah, it's a Broadway play. It's a one-woman play, but if you go to the show, you're going to think you're seeing, what, a dozen, 14 people? I mean, how many characters do you play, Sarah Jones?
I play 14 altogether, and I like to think, even though a one-person show is usually the loneliest cast party, we have a pretty good time.
Now, you wrote this piece, too.
Yes, I wrote this piece, and I have so much fun doing it for the audiences at the Helen Hayes Theater. It's incredible. It's an incredible thrill.
Bridge and Tunnel does have a message just about, well, I think every character is an immigrant, various accents, various places they came from. What's the message?
I think, if anything, it's to remind us all as Americans that we all came over at some point or another, unless we're Native Americans. You know, the stories of the Mayflower or Ellis Island or whatever our ancestors' stories might be. We all came here one way or another as new Americans at one point, and of course that story is still true today.
Well, I don't know if you read the headlines in the papers. There's been so much lately about immigration reform, and it's a hot issue, especially in California, Arizona, you know, the states near the southern border. I mean, did you want in any way to answer the controversy of today?
I think, if anything, I want to remind us that there are real human beings behind the headlines. And that we as Americans, you know, we really pride ourselves on being compassionate people, on caring about the people who work hard in our society, wherever they're from, you know, whether you have a working class background or, you know, middle class or whatever your story is, everybody's trying to make their American dream come true. So I guess I just want to remember that. And there are a couple of people in the show who just want to introduce themselves, but hi there, how are you? I'm just going to take a moment of your time. I apologize for interrupting like this, but I am a Jewish American. I came here as a very little girl. My name is Lorraine Levine, and I am in Bridge and Tunnel.
You are indeed in the play, and Lorraine Levine, right? You're one of Sarah Jones's alter egos. So there are women, and also you do some men.
Well, you know, there's men in the show, too. I like to think of myself as the star, but we joke, you know, Sarah, she's a very nice young black girl. She calls herself black. She's really more like a caramel color, if you look. But the point is that, you know, we all have so much more in common than we think.
I was thinking about the men you do. For instance, there's Muhammad, who's the host of the whole poetry evening. That basically is the scene for Bridge and Tunnel. And he seems like he's just, you know, an easygoing guy, but there's a message from him, too.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for having me here, Dan. You know, my name is Muhammad Ali. Nice to meet you, Muhammad Ali.
Oh, you're not the boxer.
Not the boxer. No, you can save the jokes about the boxing, Dan. I have heard all of them after all my years in this country, but I came here from Pakistan. You know, I like to play a good golf game with a guy like you. I like to, you know, learn about other people's culture. That is part of the benefit of being here in America, to become one society that is more strong strong because we all come from different places and we have that diversity. But there is, of course, the political climate that we want a safe country. And how do we make sure the country is safe without discriminating against the good guys? That is the question.
Sarah, I know you actually mean what you're saying there in those different voices, but where do you take your talent? If you're able to do so many voices and so many characters, I mean, heck, I guess you'll be doing Bridge and Tunnel a long time on Broadway and maybe taking it on the road, but where else can you take this?
Well, you know what's exciting? So far, I've met so many wonderful people. You know, Meryl Streep, who is a goddess, of course, of acting in theater and movies, was kind enough to produce Bridge and Tunnel when it was off Broadway downtown a couple of years ago. And through meeting her and meeting other people who do this kind of character work, I have all kinds of really, I guess, high aspirations for the kinds of things I might do in film and television. I'm just really excited to keep exploring these different voices.
And are you the kind of person who's happy to do just light entertainment? Someone says, oh, yeah, do a sitcom, you know, in which you play 16 characters. Fine? Or you always want there to be a message?
Well, I think, you know, like most Americans, I like to be entertained. I want to have a good time and laugh, but I also don't want anybody to, you know, kind of talk down to me or dumb down my entertainment, because I think some of the best stuff out there that makes us laugh also gets us, you know, thinking a little bit. So I like that kind of place in between where you get to laugh and enjoy yourself and also, you know, remember that we're smart people. Americans are, by and large, much smarter than people give us credit for.
One last thing, Sarah Jones. Why do you have this talent? Where did you hear all these accents from around the world?
Well, you know, I grew up in a multicultural family, African-American family with lots of different other roots in there. My mother comes from a mixed family, everything from Irish-American to German-American, everything else. And also, I went to the United Nations School for high school, and I come from Queens, the most diverse county in the world. So I've got my international resume down pat.
Well, you're using it well. Sarah Jones, the star on Broadway of Bridge and Tunnel. Sarah Jones, continued good luck.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Dan Revive talks to someone who's helping military families on the home front, and Peter King talks to the voice of the Yankees.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's Dan Revive.
With more than 150,000 Americans in uniform serving in Iraq and many thousands more in other parts of the world, we sometimes don't pay enough attention to the families here in the U.S. There's a new book called While They're at War. We're joined by the author, Kristen Henderson. You yourself, if I can say this, are a military wife. Your husband is a Navy chaplain who serves with the Marines. He's been in the Persian Gulf. He's been at war, so you know what it's like to worry, but it's a lot more than you don't just stay home and worry.
There is a lot more that goes on. But, you know, while he was in Iraq with the Marines headed for Baghdad during the invasion, I ran into a neighbor who said she didn't know anyone other than me was someone in the fight, and none of her friends did either. And that was when it struck me that, you know, less than 1% of the population serves anymore, so most people don't know what it's like. And since civilians are the ones that send us to war, it seemed to me that maybe people needed to spend a little time walking in these family shoes just to so they can accurately count the sacrifices.
You're hearing from your spouses almost all the time. It's a huge change, these phone calls and emails from the battlefront. What do you make of that?
Well, it can be a two-edged sword. Email and phone calls are fantastic for staying connected. They're not so great if you start arguing about who has it tough or who has it worse, because there's no winning that argument. But, you know, the other thing is that the spouse on the home front is now really integral to maintaining the morale of the folks on the front lines. And if the soldier is worrying about his family because they're struggling at home, then he's distracted from his wartime mission, and where he is, distractions can be fatal.
You said it is a two-edged sword. Those almost constant emails back and forth, they can be encouraging, but they must be distracting to the soldier at the battlefield.
If they're used, you know, to argue or to tell him about problems that he or she can't do anything about. And I shouldn't just say he, because 7% of spouses are men. They go through all the same emotional phases that women do who are left behind, but the difference is they react like men. You know, one husband I spent time with described being on the phone with his wife in Baghdad, and he heard an explosion, and while he was waiting for her to come back on and tell him she was okay, he realized he was crouched as if he was about to throw himself over her to protect her. But, you know, from 6,000 miles away, he couldn't do that.
And if the worst does happen, how does the Pentagon handle it? With great sympathy? What do you think?
For the most part, they do. The folks who come to the door are trained and very compassionate. When you talk to the widows, where sometimes the support falls down, is further down the road as they're trying to get through this mountain and blizzard of paperwork. And the folks who are assigned to help them are active duty military who have other responsibilities as well, and sometimes in the middle of it they deploy. So the spouses, the widows, don't always get all the care and that they need to work through this paperwork. Again, there are some fixes for that, and the Pentagon, I believe, is aware of it and working on it.
What about children? How much do they worry about their parents at war?
That's the real untold story, because when you send a soldier to war, you send a whole family to war, and that includes the kids. And they go through all the same emotional phases, just like the men, just like the women. The first 6 weeks is usually the most emotionally chaotic. They try and figure out, you know, how am I going to deal with this? How do I feel about mom or dad being gone? You know, smaller children will act out in nonverbal ways, and older children may try to become the super student or withdraw or act out. If you see a child who is still struggling after about 6 weeks, that usually means there's a home front parent who's struggling at home. And the kids who are most at risk are the kids whose parents never, ever get a break. So if you know someone like that, if you can help out by taking the child for a few hours and letting the parent just get a breather, that can be really helpful.
Kristen Henderson, the author of the book, While They're at War, The True Story of American Families on the Home Front. Kristen Henderson, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And thank you, Dan. And now our commentator, Charles Grodin, who is not a name dropper.
I was having lunch the other day with Barry Levinson. Barry Levinson is one of the greatest American film directors. He directed, among countless others, Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise, for which he won the Academy Award as Best Director. Barry Levinson is a smart guy. Even though it's the first time I've ever met him, it's obvious Barry is a very smart guy. And Barry asked, I'm sure rhetorically, because he couldn't have expected me to answer, Barry asked, how is it man came up with the wheel many centuries before man came up with the sandwich? Barry said, man figured out how to make and use a wheel to haul things, etc., centuries before anyone sitting somewhere said, you know, there's two slices of bread over there, there's some meat. Let's put that meat between that bread, hence what we now know as a sandwich. Much simpler concept than the wheel, you'd have to say, and yet the sandwich came centuries after the wheel. When you think about it, that's probably because necessity is the mother of invention, and no doubt we need wheels more than we need sandwiches. No disrespect to sandwiches. The sandwich is called a sandwich because it was named after the Earl of Sandwich. The reason the sandwich was named after the Earl was because the Earl wanted to eat while he was at the gambling table, so he ate food in that form while gambling, and someone, I guess, who had the authority to do it, named the sandwich after him. Before that, I assume the sandwich didn't even have a name. There's no Earl of the Wheel, because that happened so long ago they weren't even thinking of titles or giving credit. Credit all this to Barry Levinson. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
And finally, our resident baseball expert, correspondent Peter King, got to speak to one of the best-known stadium announcers in the country.
It's hard to imagine this voice anywhere but Yankee Stadium.
For the Yankees, at shortstop, number 12, Miguel Cairo, number 12.
Bob Shepard during his spring training tune-up at a Yankee Cardinals game. And hold the phone, he says he once did a guest inning at Boston's Fenway Park, of all places, where he introed ex-Yankee Reggie Jackson.
He dropped his bat and he looked around and wondered, where am I?
Starting his 56th season, Shepard says he'll keep going.
As long as I'm doing it well, as long as I like it, and as long as the Yankees are willing to pay me for doing a job that is a delight.
His pregame routine's been almost the same since he started back in 1951.
I check on the players of the visiting team, the lineup for the Yankees. I double-check and triple-check the pronunciations of the names. I go down to the press room and have dinner. I come upstairs and check with the sound man to see if there are any special announcements. And by that time, I say two or three prayers for guidance, and I begin the game.
Bob Shepard doesn't call himself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. That line, of course, belongs to another great New York Yankee. But you can clearly tell just how much he loves doing this.
Most men go to work, go to a job. I go to a game.
A game that, if you're a New York Yankee fan, would just not sound the same without Bob Shepard's voice. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Peter King at Roger Dean Stadium in Jupiter, Florida.
Shepard, by the way, this past week missed his first home opener in 55 years because of a hip problem. He's expected back at Yankee Stadium soon. I'm Howard Ehrenstein. Dan Revive returns next week.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Ehrenstein. This is the CBS Radio Network.